bragging how he was locked up with this one and that one. My only focus was music, so I really didn't give a fuck about all the shit he was talking. Green Eyes was living with DeLorean at his mom's crib in QB and started coming to the studio with him every day. He wasn't really DeLorean's uncle. I think he used to sex DeLorean's moms, and they used that uncle so the little nigga wouldn't feel bad. After a few days, I realized Green Eyes was cool. He was just an OG suspended in time. 1984 to be exact. He told me how the gang leader, Supreme McGriff, didn't take care of him while he was locked up and never sent his family money. Damn, this nigga did 15 years for them. Friday came, and I told Green Eyes I was meeting with Lynchman about the story I heard from Bars and Hooks. DeLorean hadn't told him about it. He asked if he could come and said that he'd just sit there and say nothing. Lynchman would think twice about all that thug shit they pop in when they see me, because they know me from the streets, Green Eyes said. At the Lynchman offices, DeLorean, Green Eyes, and I listened to Lynchman's appeal. They said that Bars and Hooks couldn't sign with Infamous Records, and they wanted to be paid back for the studio time, electric bills, and the phone calls made on the group's behalf. Lynchman had a compilation album coming out, so I told them that Bars and Hooks and I would do a song for it free of charge if they would squash everything. They agreed. I decided to introduce Bars and Hooks to the world through two freestyles. One over Melly Mel's The Message, and another over Frankie Beverly's Outstanding. I pressed up 5,000 records with Bars and Hooks stickers and the Infamous Records logo, got the National DJ mailing list, and contacted thousands of DJs about my plans for the new label and group, then shipped records to all of them. I had seen how the Loud staff did it, so I just did it myself. My brain was working like a robot, and my energy was through the roof. Late one night at Soundtrack Studios, Twin called, saying that he was bringing his kid, who had some hot beats and was down with DJ Muggs from Cypress Hill. Twin showed up a couple hours later with a white kid dressed in khakis and an Adidas jacket like he was straight out of Compton. He introduced himself as Alchemist and put a DAT tape in the player. The first few beats were cool, but one made me go crazy. As soon as I heard it, I claimed it for the Mobb Deep album. We put Coogee Rap on the song and called it The Realest. I wrote a real crazy verse. Never prejudge, it be the humble that'll squeeze slugs. It be the niggas standing still that'll peel guns. Spill blood for my niggas thuggin' for me. Man, you don't wanna get involved fucking with P. I spent more nights illin', less nights chillin'. The more shots it hold, the better they feel it. We'll be the dealings. Alchemist had many more where that beat came from, and has been a part of the team ever since. I'm very leery and suspicious of new faces, and initially I thought Alchemist was a fed or some type of undercover agent trying to dig up some dirt on me and my boys. My initial thoughts were, oh, the police think they slick. They got agents who know how to make beats now. But when Alchemist came around with all those dope beats, and I saw how serious he was about his career, I embraced him like a brother. He was like a gift from the heavens. That white boy got a lot of soul. We made up nicknames for him like White Chocolate, the White Vulture, and the Red White Bird. Just as we were ready to hand in the album, Loud Records switched distributors from RCA to Sony Columbia, and our album was pushed back 3 months until the deal was finalized. We were pissed. Lau had a whole new staff after the deal was done, and while they were going through those changes, our album got bootlegged. Murder Music was one of the most bootleg albums of all time. We had to record 4 new songs before we put it out, so the fans would still want to buy it. My song White Lines was getting hot, and it was time to give it a real name, so I called it Quiet Storm. Havoc and Chris Lighty wanted Quiet Storm for Murder Music instead of H&IC because Mobb Deep needed a big single. but I refused to give it up at first. After a week of havoc and Chris's convincing, though, I gave in and gave my solo song to Mobb Deep. Lil' Kim and Havoc were on the remix, and we shot videos for both my version and the remix. Rumors had been going around that Kim didn't write any of her music, so I was impressed when I saw how Kim killed her verse and wrote it herself. The four new songs we made for our album were Spread Love Not War, Adrenaline, Where Your Heart At, and Quiet Storm Remix featuring Lil' Kim. The Sunday before Murder Music dropped, one of Havoc's homies from Queensbridge, Fakie, came home from doing 9 years for shooting at some cops. I went to Freeport to visit Hav, and Fakie was sitting in the kitchen looking happy to be home, being real cool and humble. I didn't know Fakie very well. He was Havoc's boy. I met him once or twice when I first came to Queensbridge, but he got locked up right after that. I told Fakie we were having an album release party at the Tunnel the following Sunday, and that I'd give him 12 VIP passes. Sunday rolled around, and I called Fakie to meet in the early evening on 21st Street in Queensbridge, so I can give him the passes. Fakie pulled up in a white limousine with a gang of people, called Mega, Ice, Spank, Nut, and a bunch of others. I gave him 12 passes and told him to arrive early, because the passes were only good until 11 p.m. He agreed, and then I jetted to Alchemist's crib to meet Havoc and the crew. Club security tried to rush us into the tunnel after midnight because the cops were shutting the doors down. "You got a bunch of people at the side door trying to get in. They say they're with you," one of the security guards told me. "How many people?" I asked. 12. It was Fakie and his crew. I told the security that they had VIP passes. Two cops walked up. "All right, we're closing the doors for good. You people are either going in or out. Make up your mind." I tried my best to talk to the cops and let them know this was our party, but they started getting pussy. "Either go in or you're staying out." "Fuck them niggas, P. We gotta do this show," Havoc yelled, heading through the door. "Let's go." I told Havoc to wait a minute. I didn't want to leave Fakie and his boys outside without at least trying to help them get in. "Can I leave one of my boys here with you to point them out so they can get in?" I asked the club security. "Please, man. They belong inside with us. They all have passes." He looked at me like he wanted to help. "Those passes are only good until 11 p.m. It's almost 1 o'clock," he said. Then paused. "Okay, leave one of your boys with me. I'll see what I can do." I left Godfather at the door with him and went inside. The club was jam-packed. When we hit the stage to perform, the crowd went crazy. Our first time performing in the tunnel, after all those years of hanging out there. My Benz was parked outside the front door. And as soon as we stepped outside after popping bottles in the VIP, I saw Fakie and his crew looking disappointed because they couldn't get in. Fakie walked up to me, and the police told me to move my car. "Yo, meet me around the block so we could talk," I told Fakie. Around the corner, we get out the rides to talk on the sidewalk. Fakie told me that Ice's car was stolen while they were trying to get in, and Ice wanted me to pay for it. "Tell Ice to get out the car and tell me that himself," I said. Fakie got Ice. I knew Ice way better than I knew Fakie from partying together in the tunnel for years while Fakie was locked up. Ice had a dumbass look on his face when he walked up, like he knew he was about to tell me some bullshit, and he also knew that I wasn't gonna go for it. "My car's missing. I don't know if it got stolen or towed," he said. "That's not my problem," I said. "I'm not paying for it." "Forget about it, P. It's not your fault," I said, and got back in the car. "Don't even worry about it. Niggas just mad because they couldn't get in," Fakie said. "I tried to convince them to let y'all in, but y'all came too late. I told you the passes was only good till 11, I said. "At least you tried," he said. "We really mad at Havoc because we grew up with him, and it seemed like he didn't give a fuck about us." While Fakie was speaking, somebody got out the car to take a piss on the corner. I couldn't see who it was from where I was standing. Engaged in the conversation, I didn't take notice as a kid snuck around some cars, moving toward me, snuffing me in my nose. I dropped to the ground, unaware of who or what hit me. As I was getting up, I saw it was a little dirty nigga worm. He lifted the chain off my neck while I was still in the daze, and he ran to get back inside the car. "Yo, what the fuck is you doing?" Fakie screamed, as if confused. But right away, I suspected these niggas set me up. Why would they have Worm with them when they're fully aware of all the situations with him and Mobb Deep? They want to set me up? I'm the one who gave them 12 passes. Havoc always told me, "Stop hanging out on QB. Don't trust them niggas." But it's not my style to cut everybody off because of a few bad apples in a bunch. I was one of the only niggas in Queensbridge actively shooting videos, movies, showing love to the up-and-coming artists, and keeping close ties when everybody else stopped coming around. I wasn't trying to be something that I'm not. I didn't let money or fame make me paranoid to the point where I was scared to come to the hood. I didn't have a reason to have fear in my heart, because I'm genuine. Only liars have fear, because they scared somebody will catch on to their lies. The only reason I stopped dealing with a person was if they did something foul to me, and nobody from QB ever did nothing foul until then. Worm snatched my chain and then ran. I popped open my car's hood to get my gun out to shoot up that piece of shit Land Rover that he, Fakie, Spank, Mega, and Ice were in. I looked over at Stobo, and he already knew what I was thinking. The only thing that stopped me from punching holes in that Jeep was Ice and Cormega. If they wasn't in there, I'd probably be doing murder time right now. Fakie and Worm thought they were so gangster, but a real gangster nigga almost put an end to their career as petty crooks that night. I sat in the driver's seat with the gun on my lap, itching to show these wannabe thugs how I got down. But my better judgment caused me to pull off. I catch them soon enough. Godfather called later that night, telling me that Fakie and Worm robbed Noid in Queensbridge and hit him in the head with a bottle. Somebody needs to kill one of these bummy-ass clowns. At home that night, when Kiki saw my swollen face and asked what happened, I broke down crying. And it was embarrassing telling her what happened. All the years I've been in QB, I never had problems with people, because my hand didn't call for that. I wanted to murder one of these niggas for making me go home to my woman like that. The following morning, I called Fakie and told him to meet me in Queensbridge to give me my chain back. Fakie said he got it from Worm and could meet me whenever I was ready. I called Hab to tell him what was going on. "Don't go, Pete. Don't trust him," he kept telling me. "You shouldn't go to QB no more." "Man, listen, fuck all that," I said. "I'm not scared of these bitch-ass niggas. I'm gonna get my chain back." Havoc was just looking out for my safety. But what he was telling me was the total opposite of how my pops raised me. When I got to the projects, I called Fakie, and he told me that he had to go to the studio with Nas, and we could meet by the Hit Factory in Manhattan. Mind you, I'm by myself. No army, no gang, no soldiers. Just me and my 9 Ruger. Even if I wanted a gang, I didn't have anybody to turn to because my gang was telling me, "Don't do it, don't go." The only person who said they would roll with me was Jonathan Lighty, and I didn't even ask him to roll. When I got to the Hit Factory, Fakie and Cormega met me outside, and Fakie put my chain on my neck. It made me feel like a herb, like he was doing me a favor or something. "You okay?" Mega asked. "Yeah," I said. My eye was turning black from being punched in the nose. Fakie and Mega looked at me shaking their heads as if to feel sorry for me. "Wanna come to the Nas session with us?" Fakie asked. "Fuck it, why not?" I wanted to show them that I wasn't scared. So we walked into the session. I talked to Fakie and Nas about Worm. Fakie kept telling me that he didn't know Worm was gonna do that, blah, blah, blah. As long as Fakie gave me my chain back, it wasn't a problem for now, one was definitely going to have to get dealt with ASAP. The next morning, Kiki and I decided to move into a hotel until we found a new crib. Loud Records paid for us to stay in a 3-bedroom penthouse at the Flats Hotel in Manhattan, a luxury skyscraper on 52nd Street in Broadway, for 2 months. Murder Music went platinum within those 2 months, and we were on top of the world. After the lame setup that Fakie and Worm pulled at the tunnel, the very next Sunday, Worm was walking around the tunnel, and one of my boys from Hempstead cracked his face open with a Moet bottle. Worm didn't know who broke that bottle on his face or why. So just to tell people he had gotten revenge, the Sunday after that, Worm went back to the tunnel with a gun and opened fire on a random parked car. After shooting half his gun clip into the car, killing a young man in the driver's seat and wounding the others, Worm tried to run. But 3 undercover cops jumped out of a car right next to the car Worm shot up, yelling, "Freeze! Drop the gun!" Worm fired shots at the cops while running to his car, with the cops chasing and shooting at him. The cops shot up Worm's ride, riddling his body with bullets and almost killing him. Worm got 50 years to life. "CP," Twin told me, "when people try to do foul shit, all we gotta do is sit back and wait, 'cause karma's gonna get our revenge for us." Ironically, the random young man who Worm killed that night just so happened to be the boyfriend of Kiki's homegirl. Kiki and I found a mini mansion on a mountaintop in a town called Pomona in Rockland County, 40 minutes from Manhattan. I paid $500,000 for the house, 5 bedrooms, 3-car garage, and 2 acres of land. During our first week there, my daughter Tasia took her first steps in our bedroom. She was scared and started crying at first, but I held her hand as we walked together. Then I let go real slow, and she finally did it. She took 10 steps on her own. Chapter 8. I'm being watched by snake eyes. Peep them shed skin plenty times. Surrounded by crash dummies and empty minds. Get your shit together, done, see between the lines. Stay awoke to the ways of the wickedest kind. Infamous, cause of the way I write rhymes. Genesis. Soon after Murder Music went platinum in 1999, we hit the road for 2 months on the Family Values Tour. Our biggest tour yet, with Limp Bizkit, Run DMC, and a bunch of rock acts. 60 shows across America, 30,000 people a night. We took Noid and Stobo along, and Alchemist was our DJ. If we thought we knew something about groupies, we hadn't seen shit until we seen rockstar groupies. Chicks lined up in packs to get inside Limp Bizkit's dressing room after the show. We were in front of a huge crowd every night, so it was important for us to put together a real theatrical performance. There were barbed wire fences on stage, and Alchemist introduced us like we were coming home from jail to perform. Security guards walked us onto the stage handcuffed and shackled in orange prison uniforms. The guards uncuffed us, and we went crazy running around with a lot of energy. The white kids in the audience loved us. I didn't know how they were going to respond to us because most of our past shows were in the hood. But the crowd knew every word to our songs, especially Quiet Storm and Shook Ones. Man, we had a lot of fun on that tour. After the shows, we chilled with Limp Bizkit in their dressing room and tour bus. Alchemist was cool with their DJ, Lethal, who was House of Pain's DJ and produced their hit Jump Around. Al met him growing up in Los Angeles through DJ Muggs from Cypress Hill. Lethal had a nice studio set up on their bus, so we hung out and made music. One night, after the show, Limp Bizkit had a dentist backstage with a big tank of happy gas, nitrous oxide, filling up giant balloons and handing them out to get high. One dude took a whole balloon, and as he stumbled off, He fell flat on his face. I took a whole balloon to the head, and that shit felt crazy. My boy Stobo took one too. We roamed around backstage feeling like we were floating, fucking with the girls. Havoc would never try nothing like that, but I was like, fuck it, you only live once. I figured, if this is the stuff that we get at the dentist's office, then what harm could it do? I can't even remember what it felt like. It just made me laugh a lot. Ja Rule was on a tour for a few weeks, and we shared the same dressing room with him one day. I never really liked Ja's music. I understood his female targeted songs, but where I'm from, nobody listens to Ja Rule. A few years earlier, Steve Rifkin invited me and a few of my dudes to some dress-up party in the city. I'll be there, but I'm coming in my street clothes, I told Steve. That's cool, he said. I just want you there. We look real thugged out compared to the rest of the crowd. Then Ja Rule walked into the party in a loosely knitted sweater with his nipples practically popping out the spaces in the knit. It looked real homosexual. I would pay good money to see the embarrassed look on his face again when he saw us standing there. The dudes I was with didn't have any mercy, laughing right in front of him. So, on tour, we had to share the same dressing room with this dickhead, and he was putting on an ice grill, acting like he was tough now and too big to even talk to us. Something had definitely changed. The tour ended right before the new year. We went home and got our platinum plaques for Murder Music. The plaques had blood splashes on them, just like our album cover. I started hitting the studio every day to finish HNIC and the Murder Music movie soundtrack. I asked DeLorean and Drawers from Havoc's Block to help me find some new rappers from QB for the soundtrack, and they started spreading the word. I showed a lot of niggas love on that soundtrack and gave a lot of dudes their first check ever, paying people $2,500 for a song or a beat. Nas was working on an album called QB's Finest at that same time. I found out that his QB album stood for Queensborough. He was getting all the Queens rappers together like LL Cool J, Coogi Rap, Run DMC, The Lost Boys. But when Nas heard about what I was doing with the new rappers from the Bridge, he changed his Queensborough into Queensbridge because he didn't want me to be the first to get all the new artists from QB together. Nas saw himself as King of Queensbridge, so he had to be the first to pull it off. Nas didn't know that I had people around him who would come tell me everything. Nas started booking studio sessions in a room right next to me in Soundtrack Studios, so whoever I had coming doing songs, he could intercept and have them come over to his session too. Funny ass nigga. Ever since I first started coming to Queensbridge with Havoc in 1989, Nas always acted as if he was too good to fuck with Mobb Deep. He started doing songs with us after Shook Ones blew up, but Nas treated it like it was strictly business. He never tried to hang out or be cool with us, and definitely not me. Probably because he thought I was whack at first. That's understandable. I would have acted the same way if I was him. But while we were both working at Soundtrack Studios, I learned that Nas was suddenly being managed by Chris Lighty, and he started calling my crib like he really wanted to be homies now. Kiki would tell me that Nas called. We were both in shock. Why the sudden drastic change of heart? The only thing I can attribute it to is the platinum success of Murder Music. One day, Nas asked me to join his session and spit something for the QB's Finest. I did a verse on a song called The Bridge 2001. Me and my dogs coming through, we the grain, go against us, you feel the pain. After I laid my verse, Nas and I kicked it for a few hours for the first time, talking about the rap game. I told him that I thought Jay-Z was taking shots at Mobb Deep in his song Where I'm From on In My Lifetime Volume 1. Jay had a line in that song. I'm from the place. Nas and I kicked it for a few hours for the first time, talking about the rap game. I told him that I thought Jay-Z was taking shots at Mobb Deep in his song Where I'm From on In My Lifetime Volume 1. Jay had a line in that song. I'm from the place where you and your little mans hung out in every verse in your rhymes. The only person in the history of rap music who talked about Marcy projects in a verse was yours truly, me, on the infamous song Trife Life. I rhymed, every angle of the car was smoked out and tinted, so we couldn't tell if the enemy was in it. It might have been TNT. I wasn't trying to wait and see. We jetted through Marcy, cause D's ain't bagging me. Jay was definitely talking about me. On the song Money Cash Hoes with DMX, Jay said, New York's been soft ever since Snoop came through and crushed the buildings. I'm trying to restore the feelings. Jay was quieter than the church mouse when the Snoop and Pac, Mobb Deep and Biggie drama was on fire. Jay was nowhere around when all that shit with Pac was popping off. But that's how it was in rap. Niggas always going at each other, saying slick shit in their rhymes. If you said something slick, I caught it. And best believe I came right back at you. Jay wasn't shooting videos in the projects until he saw your video halftime and I shook ones in Survival of the Fittest videos, I pointed out to Nas. The projects ain't even Jay's style. He was on some speedboat, Versace, champagne party in the Bahamas getting a tan type shit. Before his success, I had seen Jay at different functions over the years, but mostly at Club Esso, where he threw Cristal parties. Biggie used to come through too. I knew Jay's style because I watched him come up. And now Jay was copying our style. Plus, Jay and his little rap protege, Memphis Bleek, were dissing Nas on songs without saying Nas's name. We should put Jay on blast in our verses for biting our style and taking subliminal shots at us, I told Nas. Nah, fuck him, Nas said. He ain't nobody to be dissing. All right, cool, I replied. I'm going to deal with him on my own. Nas didn't see what I saw. I knew exactly what Jay was doing, taking cheap shots on the low. Fuck that. Jay wanted to take indirect shots. It was my turn to shoot directly at him. Jay-Z had animosity towards Nas because he wanted Nas to be in his In My Lifetime video. Nas refused. Jay even got Nas's phone number from E-Moneybags and called Nas personally, but Nas still wouldn't do it. Things were about to boil over. The next day, I started working at Soundtrack early, aiming to complete 4 songs per day. Clean and sober again after the Limp Bizkit tour, I didn't allow anyone to smoke in Studio A while I was working. Changing my life for the better eventually helped Kiki to quit the weed and poisonous bullshit just like me. Cam'ron was in a session with a hot new producer down the hall. Cam introduced me to the producer and asked me to do a song with him for his album. I wrote my rhyme in about 20 minutes and laid it down. Then Cam came up with the chorus. The song, Losing Weight, ended up being a hood classic. Cam asked me about the dragon tattoo on my hand, and I explained that our whole Mobb Deep crew had it on our right hands. Cam then showed me a tattoo on the backside of his palm, Diplomats, written in script. Before I went back to my own session, Cam'ron told me, yo, P, you should come hang out with me and my boys in Harlem one day. Who's Cam'ron? Kiki asked late the following night. He called for you today. Cam started calling my crib looking for me. He sounds real cocky on the phone. Like I'm supposed to be excited to speak to him, Kiki said. I never called Cam back. Not because I didn't like him. I had nothing against Cam. But because I didn't like new people trying to be too cool with me. I wasn't trying to hang out with him and his crew in Harlem because my mind was in a whole nother space at that time. Strictly business. I got word from my man in Queensbridge that Little Law was home from doing 7 years for that.